the right-wing extremist enemy within the ranks of law enforcement.
When I went undercover in white supremacist groups in the early 1990s, that case was worked through a Joint Terrorism Task Force investigation, so it involved other federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, and the supervisors brought us all together one day and said, look, you're going to have to be very careful in not discussing this case when you're back at your departments or agencies, because there are sympathizers to these white supremacist groups in your agencies.
That's former FBI agent and Brennan Center for Justice fellow Mike German. We spend the hour with him today talking about his book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mike German spent 16 years as a special agent in the FBI. During his tenure, he went undercover among white supremacists and other right-wing extremists. But he became disenchanted with the FBI's commitment to fight right-wing domestic terrorism. In 2004, Mike German left the FBI and became a whistleblower. He testified before Congress that the nation's chief law enforcement agency was guilty of misconduct and mismanagement in counterterrorism cases. Now he's come out with an explosive exposé about the problem. His book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, offers a chilling insider perspective on how racist ideology persists and thrives inside U.S. law enforcement. In our conversation, German explains how decades of systemic bias, failed policy, and outright sympathies with white nationalist agendas have shaped the institutions meant to protect democracy. From January 6th to Charlottesville, from FBI surveillance priorities to underreported hate crimes, Mike German shows how government agencies have enabled far-right violence and what must happen at the state and local levels to fight back, even as our federal government is headed by the same dark forces. Let's listen now. Mike German, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You now work for the Brennan Center. Why don't you say a little bit about your work? I don't think I'll put it in the interview, but I'll put it in the intro.
I work at the Brennan Center for Justice in their Liberty and National Security program. I'm a fellow, and I've been there for a little over 10 years working on law enforcement and intelligence reform. So my work involves commenting on policy, working with members of Congress in drafting legislation governing intelligence and law enforcement authorities, and working with state and local governments to address concerns they have, particularly about federal programs, but also involving state and local law enforcement reform.
You have worked for the FBI. You went undercover in white supremacist and militia groups, right-wing militia groups, in the 1990s. But you left because you were frustrated by the response of the agency. What did you find? Why did you leave?
You're right. I did domestic terrorism work, particularly as an undercover agent in the 1990s. And after 9/11, I saw the changes. There was nobody who knew better than I did that the counterterrorism program was in serious need of reform. But I saw that the changes being made weren't designed to address the real problems and were simply designed to expand the FBI's powers, investigative powers. And I knew that as a student that was interested in the FBI about the earlier J. Edgar Hoover era abuses and realized that the expansion of FBI authority that they were seeking would just result in a repeat of those kinds of abuses, particularly targeting the Muslim and Arab communities at the time, but ultimately affecting all of us.
Yeah, and the FBI comes in for a fair amount of criticism in this book, and we're not talking about Trump's FBI, although it would be included in that. We're really talking about the FBI as an institution. But the problem is much greater and pervasive in state, local, and federal governments, law enforcement. You talk about the enemy within. The subtitle of your book is The Enemy Within. It's not Donald Trump's enemy within. And you say that you are concerned about the growing segment of law enforcement in this country that is racist, displays racist biases, acts on those racist biases. How pervasive is this? And when you say it's growing, what does that mean?
So it's hard to say because there's no agency that is collecting data about this problem. All agencies recognize the problem, but there's no agency that has a policy to either quantify it or do anything about it. When I went undercover in white supremacist groups in the early 1990s, that case was worked through a Joint Terrorism Task Force investigation, so it involved other federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. And the supervisors brought us all together one day and said, "Look, you're going to have to be very careful in not discussing this case when you're back at your departments or agencies, because there are sympathizers to these white supremacist groups in your agencies." And there wasn't any resistance to that directive. Everybody recognized that that was true, and that protecting the investigation, the integrity of the investigation, and my safety, they all agreed that they would be very careful in not sharing information about the operation beyond that what was necessary to get the operation done. That's a really remarkable kind of warning that sticks with you. Since then, as what I point out in the book, is that warning is in writing at the FBI, both in 2006 and 2015, where agents investigating domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists often find active links to law enforcement. So they actually recommend altering their counterterrorism tactics in those investigations. So my point is that if it's serious enough a problem for the FBI to alter their tactics, it's a problem that should have a methodology to protect the public from these officers who have affiliations with white supremacist groups, because that's where the real harm is. If you look at these internal documents, they're more concerned about the safety of FBI agents and law enforcement agents, which is important because these groups do kill law enforcement on a regular basis, but the integrity of their own investigations rather than how to protect the public from these officers. And that's where reforms need to be implemented to make sure that we're actually protecting not just recognizing that the problem poses a risk to FBI investigations, but that it poses risk to the public.
Did you finish writing the book before Donald Trump was elected?
Yes, it originally intended to come out before the election, but part of my contract with the FBI, if I mention cases I worked in, they have the opportunity to review it to make sure I'm not releasing any secret information, any classified information. And they held up that review. According to the regulation, it's supposed to take 30 days, but they held it up. Originally, they told me they would hold it for 11 months. Ultimately, I got the approval in 7, but too much time had passed so that we couldn't get it out before the election.
And the reason I ask that is because the book is incredibly informative about this enemy within, white supremacy within law enforcement. That has been, as you note in the book, and many, many scholars have noticed, I mean, this has been an endemic problem since the very beginning of police forces in this country, since many of them were set up in order to support and enforce slavery. And now we face a situation where the white supremacists are in charge of the FBI and the federal government. How much of the situation has changed? Is it a matter of degree or of kind?
I think it's a matter of degree. And, you know, to the extent you said people who have inclinations towards white supremacy are now in charge, you know, to a large extent always have been. And I want to explain that this isn't just a law enforcement problem. This is a problem in American society. And I think what we've seen with Donald Trump is going back to Richard Nixon after the Civil Rights Movement, there was this effort to chip away at the rights that the struggle had obtained through much effort to chip away at those. And what we saw is Republican dog whistle racism, where I have a quote from a Republican consultant, Lee Atwater, a really horrible thing that he said about how we can't use certain words, but now, you know, we will talk about welfare in a way that the racist in the public will understand that to be we're going to harm people of color in our policies. So that dog whistle racism was very persistent in our political system, but Donald Trump showed in his 2015 election that you didn't need the dog whistle. You could say it, things that were openly racist without losing support. And that opened the door to being much more public, people being much more public about their beliefs. You know, it's not just law enforcement. Obviously, we've seen the same problem in the military, but it's also prosecutors' offices and judges and corporate boards are disproportionately white. You know, that these things aren't accidents. You know, look at the U.S. Senate, you know, the most powerful parts of our government still have these striking racial disparities.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest this hour is former FBI agent Michael German, and we're talking about his book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. What I mean by the question of, is there a difference between degree and kind? There are systemic biases, which I'd like you to talk about, but now we have a Justice Department and an FBI that are headed by people who are actively sympathetic with the most extreme of the far right and the lawless. You know, they are not constrained by any laws at this point. So does that create a difference in degree or in kind in the severity of what we're dealing with?
I think it is just a matter of degree. And to the extent it's a lot more visible now, it makes it more obvious. But, you know, let's remember, it was the FBI has been given all this power since 9/11 in the name of terrorism prevention. But if you looked at the January 6th event, you know, that was an event that was planned in public. And the effort to stop the steal, i.e. stop the counting of electoral votes, it was publicly going to be a violent intervention. The Proud Boys and other far-right groups had rallied in Washington, D.C. violently twice since the election. So how could this agency that's got primary responsibility for protecting against counterterrorism not have better prepared for that attack? And there was never an explanation for that. And I think that highlights how the FBI is able to protect that element within the FBI that would have seen those protesters not as threats to our democracy, but as allies in an effort to suppress Black Lives Matter and other left-leaning activist groups.
Yes, and I think that's an important point I'd like to get into a little bit more later. But, I mean, after all, Trump was still the president at that time. Was it a problem of the infiltration and compromise of the Capitol Police, or was the problem located at a higher level?
That's a great question, and it's something that we had hoped that Congress was going to get to the bottom of with the January 6th investigative committee, but unfortunately that part of the investigation was shelved And again, I think it reinforces how deeply embedded this element is within all of our systems of power in this country, that rather than saying, okay, you know, the FBI and Capitol Police and these other agencies obviously significantly failed in a way that needs to be remedied. So we have to find out what was wrong, but instead there was an effort to push back against that no, we don't want this kind of investigation because we don't know how far up it'll go. And I think that highlights that the FBI and law enforcement affiliation with this white supremacist concept is more deeply embedded in our power structures than we want to admit.
Yeah, and just staying with January 6th for a moment, I mean, you have a really fascinating treatment of this in your book. You trace the growing alignment between law enforcement, far-right militant groups, and the far-right establishment from the 2015 Trump campaign launch through the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Talk about the Proud Boys as an example of this, how they exemplify and how they did create this growing alignment.
Sure. So the Proud Boys were interesting to me in a number of ways, and they were essentially founded during the Trump campaign and openly expressed support for Trump, but also openly discussed their violent intentions and their national scope. So typically when a group, you know, the white supremacist and far-right militant groups that I worked in the 1990s had to be very careful about their public language, you know, disavowing violence and using methodologies that were designed to hide the violent intentions and the violent acts from the public face of the organization, where this was quite the opposite. And usually when a group talks about committing public violence and works on an interstate basis, that perks the FBI's ears, right? That then makes it a federal matter for the FBI to investigate. But despite the fact that Proud Boys were involved in public violence, again, this isn't behind the scenes, this isn't hidden, it was out in public at events all across the country, we didn't see that federal intervention. And at a state and local level, we often saw the police cooperating with these far-right militant groups, including the Proud Boys, and developing friendly relationships with them. Even though, again, oftentimes these were people who were traveling from out of state into the communities that the police were sworn to protect, committing violence and being allowed to leave without any intervention or very little intervention. And it later turned out during the January 6 trials that the FBI had significant informant coverage within the Proud Boys. A number of Proud Boys were informants for the FBI's or affiliates of the Proud Boys and other federal and state and local law enforcement agencies. But what came out during the trial was, although that they were reporting on the opponents of the Proud Boys, not on the Proud Boys. I think that reflects the interest of the agencies not to collect information about this group that was traveling interstate to commit public violence, but to gather more evidence against the people they were committing violence against.
And in general, as you referred to, I think earlier, law enforcement at the state, federal, and local levels over police, generally peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters, anti-fascists, environmentalists. I mean, environmentalists are being hit with terrorism charges when they do things like, you know, liberate a few chickens from a poultry plant.
Right.
You say this is where white supremacy differs in kind from other ideologies that are labeled as extremist in the U.S. Unpack this for us. Why is that?
They're different in kind because of the what I call the proximity to power among the white supremacists and far-right militant groups. In other words, that they have direct affiliation with law enforcement officers in the military, in state and local legislatures. You know, one of the things we saw during the Trump term, first Trump term, was state and local law legislators or Republican political operatives having open relationships with Proud Boys or other far-right militant groups, sometimes hiring them as security at their events. You know, members of these groups actually ran for public office or became part of the Republican apparatus. And no other of these types of what the FBI refers to as violent extremist groups have that kind of relationship, you know, much less you look at the way, you know, the pattern of involvement in white supremacy within law enforcement going back decades, and the lack of a significant national effort to identify these officers and protect the public from them.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest this hour is former FBI agent Michael German, and we're talking about his book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. And you write about the Charlottesville Unite the Right riot, the right-wing violence there, as an example. You make the point that fascist rallies are generally intended to provoke violence. That's their point. And that law enforcement understands this. And yet they put forth a public-facing kind of both sides of them. Talk about how the Charlottesville police were well aware of the plans and yet failed to protect protesters, one of whom was killed and several were severely injured.
Right. So this is what we've seen quite a bit. And the tactic that far-right groups use, militant groups use, to have public rallies. So let me explain the tactic. This is an old tactic that they've used for decades, going back to the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, where they would hold public rallies in areas they knew they had political opposition. In other words, these aren't rallies in communities that they have a lot of support. They intentionally go to communities where they have opposition for the purpose of drawing out that opposition. And they arrive ready for a serious, violent attack where the people from the community who come out in opposition believe that it's a protest. And so the level of violence that the right-wing group is able to inflict on their opponents is much more severe. But they then present it as, oh, we were just exercising our rights to speak out, and these opponents came out and threatened us, so that's why we had to commit this violence. But it's a provocation. You know, in the 90s, when I was working these cases, law enforcement understood what they were doing and would take measures necessary to protect the communities that they were trying to harm from that harm. Usually they would, you know, cordon them off in an area where they couldn't interact with the community members. So I was surprised to see at Charlottesville, but at events all across the country, that law enforcement would simply allow them to go melee into the crowd of community members. So it was definitely a choice. And in the public, they would often talk about it as intelligence failures. Oh, we didn't know this was going to happen. But anybody who's followed these groups could understand that the people involved had committed violence at previous rallies. So it shouldn't have been a matter of some secretive intelligence, and also that you know, the groups were very public about their intent to commit violence. This, you know, in the age of social media, it doesn't require some, you know, deeply embedded source to tell you what's going on. They're quite public about their intent to commit violence. Unfortunately, that was what alerted me and caused me to start writing about these issues.
You were also surprised at the lack of response after the Unite the Right march. So it wasn't just a failure to protect the community from these right-wing, violent right-wing demonstrators, but also the failure to hold him accountable afterward. Talk a little bit about what happened.
Right. Because of social media and live streams, I pretty much watched the events as they occurred, even though I was hundreds of miles away from them. And while I was shocked by the lack of a law enforcement response at the time, I thought, well, at least now there will be significant evidence of who was committing the violence. So the police, I imagined that the police would follow up and just start arresting one person after another, and particularly that the FBI, because again, many of these people had traveled interstate to be involved in this kind of violence. People with violent criminal records traveling interstate and committing violence in public. But, other than the federal charges against Alex Fields, who was the person who ran his car into the crowd and killed Heather Heyer, injured many others, there wasn't really a federal response. And the availability of the evidence was made clear when ProPublica and Frontline produced a documentary about a year afterwards that they had been tracking certain violent members of a group based in California that had been training to commit violence and then traveling to these different events, committing violence in public, and somehow being able to just walk away without charges. So it was only after the documentary came out that the FBI started pursuing those members, and only pursued the people who the ProPublica journalists had focused on. So, didn't take that as an opportunity to look more broadly at the people who had committed violence. And it took the survivors of the attack to gather the evidence that had existed before the attacks. In other words, the online chats that the organizer had participated in that had leaked right after the rally, that showed that this wasn't a spontaneous event, that they had planned for violence to occur and came prepared to commit that violence. And the civil suit resulted in monetary fines against these organizers, but we didn't see any effort for the federal government to bring criminal charges.
Michael German. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, Policing White Supremacy, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. We're talking today with former FBI agent and Brennan Center for Justice fellow Mike German about his book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. It's a powerful and urgent look at how white supremacist ideology has infiltrated law enforcement and how federal and local agencies have failed to address violent extremism from within their ranks. Let's get back to our conversation. Now, under Biden in 2023, so that's not Trump, the way it was Trump in January 6th or now, the FBI director said that although the Bureau had doubled the number of its domestic terrorism investigations since 2020, and, I don't even know if that's significant, it still considered international terrorism the country's primary threat. Do you disagree with this, and why?
I do disagree with it because it's not based on empirical evidence about the nature of the threat. So we started working with Congress back in 2015 after the Charleston, South Carolina attack on the Mother Emanuel Church by white supremacists. And one of the things I argued was that we needed data. The data should be driving the FBI's counterterrorism efforts. And what you need to know is which groups are more active and which are more deadly. So bills were drafted that would have required the FBI to produce the number of domestic terrorism incidents that occurred, what groups were responsible for them, and the number of fatalities for each of the categories that the FBI has in its program. So the FBI's counterterrorism program was broken into ideological categories. So there was a separate category for white supremacists, for far-right militias, for what they called black identity extremists or black separatists, environmentalists, animal rights activists, etc. And if you had that data, you could then look at how many investigations were open, how many indictments and convictions were obtained, so that you could see where the FBI was putting its resources. And if the FBI was directing its resources towards groups that were not active or not involved in deadly violence, that would show a misuse of those resources. Likewise, if they were focusing on a high number of investigations on groups where no terrorism charges were ever laid, that would show abuse of their authorities, right? That they're targeting groups based on their ideology who are not involved in criminal acts. But that data requirement wasn't passed until 2020. And for the last 5 years, the FBI acknowledged they don't collect domestic terrorism incident data, and they don't know how many people white supremacists kill each year. And fortunately, there are private groups and academic groups that try to collect this information from public sources. And what that data shows, even though it's very inconsistent, is that in almost every year, white supremacists kill more Americans than any other groups within these categories of violent extremists that the FBI has created. So if that represents some subset of the homicides, it's something that should drive more investigations to investigating violent white supremacists and far-right militants. But the FBI refuses to collect that information, I think, because they know that it would direct their resources away from groups they prefer to investigate, like environmentalists, because there are wealthy patrons who are more concerned about that kind of protest than they are about white supremacist violence.
And in fact, let's talk a little bit about the language that is used to obscure or to do both sidesism. You say that just before the Unite the Right rally in 2017, the FBI warned of a new category of domestic terrorists that it labeled black identity extremists. So that's one kind of language. Another kind of language we've been hearing a lot recently is that when progressive march in the streets or demonstrate, they're accused of being paid protesters. We've heard that a lot recently, but that's been a trope that's been around for a long time. And then the whole use of the word Antifa by the right, rather than spelling out what that actually means, which is anti-fascist.
That's right. And I think the problem is foundationally around this concept of terrorism, that the word itself is politicized, right? We distinguish violent acts that we call terrorism from other violent acts by its political nature. So unfortunately, because we're talking about a political topic, any kind of counterterrorism effort is also infected with politics. And what we've seen governments around the world do is use this concept of terrorism to target political opponents rather than actually focusing on the violence itself. And, you know, obviously the FBI has a long history under J. Edgar Hoover of targeting the civil rights movement and anti-war movement, using this concept of radicalization, that it's not the handful of violent people that might be associated with a movement that are the problem. It's the people who are spreading bad ideas. And so the focus turns to the ideologies rather than focusing on who's actually committing violence. And what gets counted as terrorism is very different. And particularly post 9/11, when the FBI adopted this posture of prevention of terrorism as their number one mission rather than solving terrorist crimes, what we found is the FBI spends significant counterterrorism resources doing suppressive investigations of advocacy groups.
Yes, and that's about to get a lot worse. But so let's talk a little bit about this book you wrote, Mike German. You wrote this book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, as a call to action. So talk about some of the practices that are current that impede FBI investigations, even when it's not particularly maybe a lack of will. You point, for example, to the referral to state and local governments for prosecution, where the FBI makes a referral and then steps back from the case.
So if a white supremacist kills somebody in a racist attack, the FBI might call that an act of domestic terrorism, but more often they would refer to it as a hate crime. And that Congress has reflected the will of the people, passing 5 federal hate crime laws. So the federal government has jurisdiction over these crimes. But the Justice Department's policy is to defer the investigations of hate crimes to state and local authorities. And that creates a number of problems. And from a federal perspective, results in a significant loss of intelligence, because many state laws aren't very effective, and many law enforcement agencies and prosecutors don't lay those kinds of charges. So even where a state might have a hate crime law on the book, it doesn't get used in practice. So whether that crime will ultimately be investigated or prosecuted as a hate crime is unknown. And even just getting the intelligence of who's committing hate crimes and where are they occurring becomes difficult because of this dispersal of the cases to thousands of state and local police agencies. And Congress, again, trying to do answer to the will of the public in 1990, passed a statute requiring the Justice Department to report the number of hate crimes that occur nationally. But again, the Justice Department just defers to state and locals, asking them to voluntarily report the number of hate crimes. And only about 15% of police agencies acknowledge that hate crimes occur within their jurisdictions. So there's this huge black hole of knowledge and intelligence about who's committing these crimes. And it suppresses the impact of those crimes, or the knowledge about the impact of those crimes, to the policymakers. So we kind of throw some numbers out just to highlight it. The Justice Department regularly does crime victim surveys. So they'll go out to people who've been victimized by crime and survey them about the crime. And reports from those kinds of surveys have indicated there are about 200,000 to 230,000 violent hate crimes every year. With 5 federal statutes, the Justice Department prosecutes roughly 25 to 50 hate crime defendants each year. And the small number of police agencies who report about somewhere between 7 and 11,000 hate crimes each year. And that's where you see the national numbers being discussed in the media. But you have to understand that's just a subset of the numbers that actually exist. Unfortunately, we just don't know about that. But again, that's part of this systemic problem of not really treating these kinds of violent crimes that often result in fatalities as serious national security and law enforcement issues.
So there are two issues here. One is the failure to police white supremacy, but also the failure that we've been talking about to police white supremacist police and policies. You say that effectively policing white supremacy means limiting the role of the police. What do you mean by that?
Right. Often when there's a crime problem not being addressed, there's an assumption that, well, if we give the police more resources, they'll be more effective at it, either expand their legal authorities. And during the last 10 years, there's been an effort to create a broad new domestic terrorism law, or give them more resources, more officers and agents, and more money to work with. But what we've seen over and over again regarding the deficient response to white supremacist violence is that law enforcement has all the authority they need, and they choose not to use it. And this came up particularly around this idea that there isn't a domestic terrorism law. This kind of became a mantra by many former Justice Department officials who were pushing for a broad new law. that there was no domestic terrorism law on the books, which of course came as a shock to me because I was working domestic terrorism cases in the 1990s and nobody suggested we didn't have significant statutory authority to do that. In fact, you can look it up. The United States Criminal Code has an entire chapter called terrorism, and it defines international and domestic terrorism and then goes on to list 57 federal crimes of terrorism, 51 of which apply to entirely domestic acts. So it's an effort to distract from the real problem, which is that these law enforcement agencies choose not to investigate and prosecute these cases. And it came up during the January 6th trials because often the prosecutors in those trials would try to convince a judge to hold the subjects in detention pending trial, and they would have to point out these defendants are charged with a federal crime of terrorism. And there was kind of shock in the media that, wait a minute, I thought there wasn't a domestic terrorism statute. But it was all just a semantic game that they were playing, trying to distract from what the real problem is, which is that over many administrations and many years, the law enforcement simply chooses not to prioritize these cases.
And yet, under Biden, they were in jail, at least some of them were. Now they are out. They've all been pardoned and are being feted and lionized by the Trump administration. What impact does this have on our security?
You know, I'm not very good at predicting the future, but I certainly have concerns. Typically, what we've seen in the past is that when a person in authority gives permission, a green light to political violence, that political violence increases. And I think it's very hard to predict how it will manifest. And, you know, people assume that white supremacists and far-right militant groups would be Trump supporters, and many of them are. But many are not. And when you look at the young man who attempted to assassinate President Trump and shot him, you know, shot him in the air, could have killed him. And a more recent case where a young man had killed his parents and as part of a plot, apparently he had written out a plot that included assassinating Donald Trump, that these individuals are immersed in the same malignant conspiracy theories that are prevalent in the white supremacist and far-right militant communities, that the assumption that they would support a mainstream political person is the same way they supported Blue Lives Matter. You know, that during the first Trump administration, you often saw far-right militant groups flying Blue Lives Matter flags and putting the patches on their uniforms. But on January 6th, what we saw, and many other instances before that, that these groups attack law enforcement officers, that that's just a feigned support to make a temporary alliance that would allow them to further their mission, which is not the same as any mainstream political group or certainly law enforcement. So it's going to be hard to predict how this violence will manifest, but certainly that the perception they have is that they are allowed to commit violence so long as they can frame it as supporting the administration. And an equally powerful message was sent to law enforcement that investigating and prosecuting far-right violence is not a career-enhancing methodology.
Right. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with former FBI agent Michael German about his book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. You know, I want to go back to, I think it was 1990 when the Waco incident happened. Was that when it was?
It was about 93, I think, 92 or 93.
Under Clinton, because that was a time when the federal government, I guess, well, I don't know if those were right-wing domestic terrorists, but they certainly put a stop to that. That organization, a lot of people were killed. Do you think that kind of an answer, that kind of state response is what's necessary?
No, and it's important to, if we're going to use those examples from the 1990s to understand would happen. And it, you know, it might be more easier to talk about the Ruby Ridge incident rather than Waco, because the group itself was not necessarily, it certainly wasn't white supremacist and wasn't really tied very directly to the far right movement until after the incident, where Ruby Ridge involved somebody who was part of one of the traditional white supremacist groups, or at least affiliated with them. But that was not an FBI investigation. That was an investigation by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And the FBI's involvement came after there was already a U.S. Marshal shot and killed and members of the Weaver family shot and killed. But I think reflected a sort of whiplash effect, where the lack of focus on these groups meant that when some bad incident happened, there was an overreaction to it, rather than understanding how these groups operated and the best methodology for resolving those kinds of conflicts. And, you know, I was seeing progress in the way the FBI handled a later siege with a Montana group that called themselves the Freemen. You may remember that in the later 1990s, where the FBI basically just set up a perimeter and waited them out, rather than engaging in an attempt to overtake the property. And, you know, fortunately didn't result in any deaths the way that Waco and Ruby Ridge did. But again, there's an assumption that because that event happened, there was a focus on those groups, but that focus was very rare and typically occurred after some horrible incident rather than before it. You know, the Oklahoma City bombing is another example where the lack of attention to it allowed a complex criminal conspiracy to reach fruition rather than to interdict it. And the focus on these groups tends to be episodic and tends to want to imagine each incident stands alone. And this was true even with January 6, where many of the individuals and groups involved in the attack on the Capitol had been violent at other protests or had engaged in other criminal acts prior to January 6th. And in some cases, people who participated in violence on January 6th continued to commit crimes after January 26th. But the Justice Department approached the investigation as if the crime started that morning and ended that afternoon, and therefore left a lot of evidence on the table, number one, but also some charges that could have been laid. And it's a little hard to be critical about the nature of the investigation, because it was the largest investigation in the FBI's history, and I can understand how that would have been very difficult to conduct. But they didn't get around to charging, you know, at least 100 people or more that the public had identified as committing violence outside the Capitol, because they prioritized initially people who trespassed in the Capitol, charging misdemeanor cases, rather than focusing on the people who committed violence, who maybe never got into the Capitol. And that was a huge strategic and tactical error, because it burned a lot of resources on cases that were not significant and didn't result in time, and reinforced the false narrative that these were just protesters who got out of hand, right? That if they had focused entirely on the violence and not on misdemeanor cases, it would have been much harder for supporters of January 6th defendants to make that argument that this was just a protest that got out of hand.
Well, I think the even greater strategic error was not to prosecute Donald Trump immediately after Biden came in, instead wait 2 years, dilly-dally, until the man could just run out the clock and become president again. That is, to me, the greatest failure. But given that right now that criminal is in the White House, we have a constitutional crisis. Many of the recommendations in your book are wonderful recommendations, but what can we do now at a time when the government is actually controlled by the far right, all three branches?
That's a great question. And again, because the book was planned to come out before the election, I didn't talk as much about this, but I do have a lot of recommendations for what state and local government can do. And I think that's where the focus needs to be, where the recommendations I made for the federal government are probably not going to be implemented anytime soon. We do have a federal system that state and local governments can take the measures necessary to protect their communities. And communities themselves can also take measures to protect each other. And building that kind of solidarity is important when what we've seen in history is when an authoritarian takes power, they start by targeting groups that have the least political support. And once they can justify using extra legal measures against that group, then they can start to expand to others until they ultimately capture everyone. And so when the administration is targeting what they call criminal aliens, everybody has to recognize that's a threat to all of us, not just to somebody who might have committed a crime when they were in an undocumented status. And what we have to do is make sure that we're standing up for the rule of law in all cases, even if it's against people we don't like, and ensuring that due process and the rule of law protects the worst among us if it's going to protect us.
But how do we deal with this enemy within when the enemy within is at the head of all three branches of government? What kinds of measures can be taken now to protect us from the axis of, you know, white supremacists and the police?
Again, we have a federal system. So while there's control of the three branches of the federal government, states can protect themselves and localities can protect themselves. And I see it as kind of the flip side of the civil rights era, where you had states infringing on the rights of their citizenry, and the federal government had to step in to protect those constitutional rights, that here we have to see the state governments and the local governments stepping up to protect their citizens from federal overreach. And, you know, we're seeing that around the country with state attorney generals filing suits to protect the state interests. And what we have to see is more of that. But like I said, we also have to not rely on law enforcement and make sure that we're doing the things necessary to protect our own communities and developing methodologies and systems that work effectively without the police. Because again, the police have a history of being part of the problem rather than part of the solution when we're talking about white supremacists and far-right violence.
What can state and local governments specifically do to investigate and hold to account these white supremacy? They're not just white supremacists. Let's just say far-right groups. What can state and local governments do to investigate and hold them accountable?
So there's a lot that, and it's fascinating because when I've talked to the police leaders about this, they always frame the problem in a way that doesn't actually describe it. So they'll say, you know, hey, we don't really have the authority as police administrators to delve into the deepest beliefs of our officers and, you know, monitor their social media activities off the job 24/7. You know, how are we supposed to find these guys? And I always point out, they're not hiding. You don't have to, you know, get a polygraph machine out, not that those work anyway. What you have to do is listen to your officers. The employees of that agency know who the problem officers are. All you have to do is ask them and protect them once they tell you. Because unfortunately, what we've seen in recent times is that it's much more dangerous to your law enforcement career to report the racist misconduct of a fellow officer than it is to engage in racist misconduct. And that's what needs to change: stronger whistleblower protection so that officers can report out problem officers to their own chain of command, to their own police department. And police leaders should want that information and have a direct interest in protecting those whistleblowers. But they also need to listen to the community. The community knows who the problem officers are because they're the ones feeling that impact. But too often what we see when community complaints are laid at the police department, against the police department, we'll see police managers defend against them rather than use them as an opportunity to clean up problems within the police department. And, you know, this is most obvious during when employees of these agencies report racial or ethnic discrimination, where the police leadership has an obligation to both the employee who's accused and the employee who's claiming that they've been harmed. But what we always see is the police department protecting the person who's been accused rather than their employee who's been harmed. And those are things that they can change just through their own authorities. They don't need the federal government to come in. They can do that on their own. And they can write effective regulations and policies to govern these issues. And many police agencies have those on the books, but they have to be enforced. So there's much that can be done. There just has to be a will to do it and a leadership commitment to make sure it becomes part of the process rather than treating this as a one-off problem that, you know, a one-time effort to identify problem officers and then get back to regular activities. That's not how this works, right? This is part of our society. And when the police recruit a new class of officers, some of them are going to be influenced by these ideologies and end up committing the same kind of abuse. That's what we've seen over and over again throughout history. So it's got to be a persistent effort.
Well, we have to end now, but this is just a terrific book, and it's also a great read, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Mike German, this is such an important book. My heart just wants to say, I really hope that those reforms are possible, that we still have a country where that can happen.
Thank you.
Mike German is a fellow in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. In addition to Policing White Supremacy, he's the author of Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Will Potter about his new book, Little Red Barns. The Washington Post called it an impassioned and thoroughly researched examination of factory farming and how it harms animals, the planet, and us. We also talk with the folks over at Project Censored about their annual report, State of the Free Press. It covers the most important stories the mainstream press underplayed or ignored. Don't miss it. And I have exciting news. I've started hosting a new podcast for Change Hampton, an organization dedicated to promoting a new land ethic that creates habitat for wildlife, birds, and beneficial bugs. The podcast name is Change Hampton Presents, Changing the World, One Yard at a Time. Look for it wherever you get your podcasts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.